number at the top, 1SR, on the front page on the
Oh,
right-hand
sure.
corner.
Yes, 1SR. So page 10 talks about the exemptions to the 45-month limit. So the first exemption, A, under that section 5 down at the bottom, you see that, or halfway down the page?
Yes, okay.
Okay, so A is talking about, there was concern about children who were minors who were on their parents' parents received temporary assistance when they were minors living in the household. And one of the concerns about the way the legislation was drafted was that because their parents had been on it when they became an adult, if they needed it, then the time that had been used when they were a minor would count against them. So this does not count against them.
Okay.
So those children, should they need this help as they become adults, would still, under this current legislation, have access to 45 months of support. And then the second one is B is the individual who has been battered or subjected to extreme cruelty. And again, it puts a maximum number of people to which this could apply, but there is that exemption in there for 20%, up to 20% of the average monthly number of families to which the temporary assistance is provided during a particular fiscal year. And let's see. Yes, and that's really it as far as I see with the exemptions. If I run across anything beyond that, but I actually think it's covered under federal law, and I think that we, it may have been the state who added in the exemption for people who are victims of domestic violence and abuse.
Well, I'm glad that's been put in there. Senator, were you on this committee that heard this bill originally? I know you've worked really hard
yes.
on it along with...
Yes. I serve on the Children and Families, Seniors, Children and Families Committee.
Did, let me see. I wrote down a couple of questions.
Sure.
So when you heard this bill in committee, I see that lots of folks testified against it.
Yes.
And they're, according to the bill brief I have, there was only one entity that testified for it, and the senator from Barry has said that, and I don't doubt what he says at all, that we need to rein the program in to satisfy the federal government. So who in the state of Missouri administers this program here?
The Department of Social Services.
So wouldn't they testify on behalf of this bill if the feds needed this rein, if we were in...
Out of compliance with the federal
yeah,
requirements?
Yeah, if we were about to...
Well, you know, it's interesting because we've had a lot of... there has been discussion around that. And, you know, the people who are in this program that are out of compliance at the very end that the senator from Barry is discussing are the people who are struggling the most. Remember we said it's an average of 22 to 26 months that a Missouri family stays on the program.
Right.
There are people that are way below that, that need that help for a much shorter period of time, and there are people way above that. And the people who are way above that, that need this for a longer period of time to get into compliance, those are the most vulnerable among us. Those are struggling the hardest. The people who, through this program and through their hard work, get jobs and meet these requirements are then no longer need to be on this temporary assistance. So when we push them off, we also push the numbers of people who are in compliance off. So it's one of those conversations with, you know, that needs to be had with the federal government to say, here is why our numbers look the way they do. We're trying very hard to make sure that people who are now have 30 hours a week, who don't need this money, who are working, that those people are no longer part of the program.
So the 60 months, is that a federal standard?
Because 60 months was the federal standard that was put into place, I forget which Republican administration it was, but it was a bipartisan decision that 60 months was the appropriate amount of time at the federal level. And again, these are it's a federal program.
So you've worked on this a long time. Has the folks that have been receiving these benefits in the last few years, has it increased, decreased? Is there more families taking advantage of this program or less people taking advantage of this program?
You know, I don't have the historical data. I know I have it somewhere in here, but it's not at
I think
the...
you have a lot in there, Senator.
I have, and this is just one of the several files that I have. But, well, actually, the TANF caseload, here it is. I happened to turn to it. How about that? So, the number of unemployed, all right, so from December of 06 to December of 13, this is national TANF cases. The number has gone down, and during that same time period, this graph is showing me that the number of unemployed, well, it doesn't show me unemployment, but the number of unemployed have gone down. So now TANF cases, I'm trying to figure out which, it's a color graph printed in black and white, so you know how hard those can be to read.
Sure.
It's a gradual curve upward during the mid, during 2000 and, well, actually TANF. TANF has been on a pretty even keel from 2008 to 2013. It shows it dropping a little bit now. Now, let me go specifically to Missouri. In poverty in 1994 and 1995, we had 109,500, I think this is talking about families with children. In 2012 to 2013, the families in poverty have gone up almost, it looks like 25,000 to 137,700. And the people in deep poverty has almost doubled in that time period. So from 1994, 1995 to 2012, 2013. The state TANF to poverty ratio in 1994 and 95 was 82. In 2012, 2013, 28. So that has gone down. And so it looks like people are more in need, especially people in, deep poverty, and yet the number of people receiving TANF benefits have gone down. So we're making things a little harder for those people who...
So thinking of that, you know that my daughter's coming in to visit from out of the country.
Yes, so I know.
To make everything a little easier. I went grocery shopping this weekend. I went and bought diapers. And I haven't bought diapers, I guess, since, 25 years. And I bought diapers. And I think I bought 210 diapers, and they were not a name brand diaper, and I bought them at Costco.
Okay.
So, I was on the cheap anyway.
You got a good price.
Yeah.
But?
$40.
Yeah,
$40. So somebody receiving these benefits, if they receive the average $292 a month.
That's not even an average. That is on the high end for a family of three.
Okay, and they can't make any more than 200 and some odd dollars a month or 300 some odd dollars a month.
There is, if they are fulfilling the work requirement and they are living in poverty, then they are eligible for those dollars. So,
I can't imagine. I can't imagine.
I was actually thinking about diapers this weekend.
I bought rice cereal. I bought formula. I bought the diapers and wipes. And
I was thinking about those things that we don't often think about when we're here talking about food and shelter and clothing. Diapers. Oh, my gosh. They're expensive. And
well, when we were buying them, we thought they were expensive.
I thought they were expensive
we
back
them.
When I was buying them for my kids, and they're 26 and 25 now. So, to be a family who is living among the poor, these are the poorest people, the most vulnerable, poorest people in the state of Missouri who are accessing these dollars, and to think of those things that they need to pay for with them.
Our baby formula. Do you know that most stores, not the grocery stores, but department stores that I might go to or big box store, they lock up the baby formula.
Really?
They lock it up. You have to go get somebody with a key to get you out the cart and the baby formula. Well, after I purchased it, I know why they're locking it up.
Pretty expensive.
But it is, and that's the powder. I would never buy the powder when my kids were little. I bought those big 24-ounce cans or whatever they are, and I can remember having to go in the middle of the night to get something different because somebody was sick and I was...
Right.
Yeah, and the price of it is astronomical. It's,
right.
I think, a carton like this, like the size of less than a gallon of ice cream, not the big, thin ice cream.
Right, and that's to add water to that.
Yeah.
And,
it's frightening. So I don't know how somebody without any means
Well, and you know, you think of people with infants or people that with kids that are still drinking formula or drinking from a bottle, and kids that are still in diapers. But then, you know, these also are families with kids who are a little bit older. So kids who are going to kindergarten and first grade. And, you know, I think back to even when I was going to kindergarten, you know, we didn't have a lot of money. But I had a nice, clean, new dress
yep.
for the first day of kindergarten.
New shoes, and
shoes that fit me. And, you know, one of the things we talk about, because I work with the National Council of Jewish Women, who does a back-to-school store for kids in the community that need clothing and school supplies and backpacks and shampoo and underwear and coats and shoes to start school each year. And there are about 1,000 kids served every year. And I remember learning about, this is the first time I heard about it, was through this experience, kids who would outgrow their shoes, and instead of being able to afford new shoes, the toe of the shoe was cut out so the child's toe could slip into it and, you know, not rub up against the end, but
wow.
so that that child would have a sole under her foot so that she was able to go to school. So as these kids get older, and imagine, you know, you're a 13-year-old girl. I mean, some of those supplies for girls who are reaching maturity, think about how much those cost.
Sure.
And think about the fact that these kids, you know, they're now being conscious of members of the opposite sex, and they want to have, you know, their hair clean and their clothes clean. And they
well,
want
their self-esteem. Imagine what that does
their
to a
13-year-old
boy or girl.
Their self-esteem is tied
and
into this.
Shampoo, it's not a luxury at my house. And I have three girls. I mean, buying shampoo is like buying baby formula.
Right. It's not cheap. And even toothpaste. I'm always amazed at how much a tube of toothpaste costs. So all those things that we just, you know, go back to our apartments or our homes and we have them. And we take them for granted. But they are a choice between, do we have something for dinner tonight or do I get you the shampoo that you want for your hair?
Well, aren't we lucky that the inconvenience that not having those things might mean we have to run out at an inconvenient time of the day or night, and we have the means to pick them up?
Well, right.
To have it there when we need it the next day.
To have it there when we need it. And, you know, even imagine, well, there are so many things about being a person who is having to struggle with living in poverty. I mean, you talked about if your kid was sick and you had to go get a different kind of formula.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, imagine if you are poor and your kid is sick in the middle of the night and you don't have a car. And what do you do? And do you, you know, you maybe can't call somebody to come. I mean, how do you deal with the day-to-day little crises, small little even annoyances to us that can become a crisis for somebody who doesn't have the money to pay for what they need or doesn't have the ability to get transported to where they need, or he needs to make sure that all the children are with him or her, because what are you going to do, leave a little one at home while you run up to the pharmacy to get a prescription for the baby that's sick?
That was, you know, one of the saddest things, and I used the example of the formula being locked up, and I asked one time at one of the stores, well, why are you doing this? Because I'd never seen it, and this was at a store in my close to my home, and I was just surprised that we have to lock up food. It was food, and the reason people were stealing it was to sustain their families. You know, of course, it's kind of like the, you know, another one like that is laundry detergent. Now,
oh, right.
There are some people
right.
that steal that, and they steal baby formula to sell it on, you know, to other people to make a profit. But I would say the majority of the time, these are people trying to sustain their children.
Right.
And they have to break the law to get what they need to take care of their kids.
Well, and, you know, I don't want anybody to think we're condoning that, because we're certainly not. But I want to tell you a story, and I've told it on the floor, I think, before, but I think it drives home the point of what some people who are struggling with poverty are living with. A friend of mine was tutoring a young girl, an eighth grade girl, and I know I've said this before, the girl was falling asleep in front of the tutor. I mean, it was just a one-on-one tutoring situation in math, and my friend said to her, why are you so tired? Were you up partying last night? And the eighth grade girl said, no. My mom got home from work at midnight, and then we had to go to the laundromat. Now imagine, you know, you're a mom and a daughter, You live together. The mom doesn't want to send the daughter to the laundromat on her own, but the mom doesn't also want to go on her own at midnight when she gets home from work. I mean, lives are very different than those than the one you live here, or that I live here, or that our colleagues in the Capitol building live.
When was the last time you were at a laundromat, Senator?
Yeah, well, exactly.
I can tell you when I was there, and it was an inconvenience. It was the middle of the night because I was working nights, and the school uniforms weren't clean enough for my liking, and the washer was broke. So I ran up and did the school uniforms in the middle of the night. That was an inconvenience.
Right, right.
That was,
and
you know,
you were
going
to get the laundry.
My kids were going to a school that required school uniforms. That's 20 years ago. So you know what that meant. I had the money to send them to the school I chose to send them to buy the uniforms.
And to get the washing machine.
That's
I got
right.
fixed the next
right.
day,
and
right?
I could get the washing
right.
machine
you can make
fixed,
a call. But, and, you know, these are people who, I don't know, maybe they do have washing machines, but this particular family did not. And I told that story, and another woman told me the story of the second grade boy, same thing. She was tutoring him in reading. He was very tired. Why are you so tired? He said, last night was my night to sleep on the floor. So he and his siblings rotated turns of sleeping on the floor. These are the kinds of situations people are living in. And frankly, how much, you know, you don't have to have the whole bed spring and the whatever that bottom mattress.
Box springs.
Right, the box springs. You can just have a mattress, but this family could not afford that mattress so that every one of their children could sleep on something comfortable, get a good night's sleep, and go to school comfortable the next day. You know, when you're a 15-year-old, and you're going to school and you don't feel like you're embarrassed because maybe you're not wearing the clothes or the cleanliness of your clothes, or maybe you weren't able to take a shower because there is no hot water. When you're coming to school like that, how do you think that impacts your ability to succeed and do well? And we keep talking about the opportunities we want to provide for these families, and we want to get them to work and out of poverty. And this TANF is really a lifeline for some people, and we're going to, because the Heartland Institute put out a report that said we weren't being strict enough, we
right.
could be doing more, we're going to take away this.
We're going to do more, Senator.
We're going to take away this option. I found in my file the exemptions from the work requirement,
oh,
if
okay.
you'd like to see that. So I'll tell you, for caregivers or parents, if they're taking care of a child who is 12 months of age or younger, so they'll still get there if there are three of them, up to $292. If they are caring for a disabled household member, if they are permanently and totally disabled, and if they are age 60 or over. Whoops, that's hitting a little close to home.
Yeah.
But and then temporary exclusion for caregivers or parents who are temporarily disabled, pregnant in the third trimester, a victim of domestic violence, or a victim of a natural disaster. So some of these exemptions and exceptions or exclusions do exist. But let's go back, you know, the very first one, the exemption. If you're taking care of a child 12 months of age or younger and you qualify for TANF, if you've applied and you qualify, so you're going to get some money. But again, you're not going to be working. You're going to be paying rent. You're going to be paying for those diapers. You're going to be, if you're not nursing, you're going to be paying for that formula. Eventually, in that 12-month period of time, you're going to be paying for that child's food. You're going to be paying to turn on the heat and keep the water going and all those other utilities that you have to deal with. And you want to keep that baby, you know, dressed and safe.
Right.
So these are people who, again, I just feel like I can't emphasize it enough. They're living a very different life than you and I are. And until you hear the stories of what life is like. You know, what's it like for the child who goes home after school on a winter day to that cold home or apartment? It's freezing cold. You go in, you don't have heat on, and frankly, you know, you don't have heat on. How do you study? How do you do that and
how
get prepared for your next day at school? So there are ripple effects to the consequences of pulling this rug out, this safety net out from under the families that we're talking about.
Thank you, Senator, and thank you for the inquiry.
Thank you.
I think you've answered my questions. Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator from the 9th District, for what purpose do you rise?
Thank you. May I inquire of the Senator from the 13th?
Senator from the 13th, do you yield?
I do.
She does. Proceed.
Good. I appreciate, of course, your discussion. You said you had gone, and what did you say you bought for your granddaughter? You talked about the $40.
Well, the stuff we needed are the stuff that I frivolously spent money on. That, you know, the people we're talking about would never even imagine.
No.
Doing what I did.
So we're talking about the stuff you need, because these are basic needs.
The diapers were $39. I think the box of baby wipes, they were 14, and there was a lot of them in there.
Right.
You know, and I looked at those and didn't buy them because she said that she needed something without aloe in them.
Oh, I see.
So I had to go someplace else, and I sent one of the other girls off to do that today. So I bought those. I bought rice cereal. I bought formula. The baby, I told her not to pack up a lot of stuff because they have to take everything back with them.
Right.
So I bought a couple of bottles just to have bottles there and some spoons for the baby. I was up around $100, but, you know, just on necessities, on things that she had to have when she brought the baby here. I didn't have a, you know, what I didn't have, I had one when she was here last time, just a sheet for the baby bed mattress.
Right.
And I'm saying for the baby bed mattress.
All those things you don't
Some
think
people
about.
We're talking about don't have the baby bed.
Right.
And I have the bed in
that's
my house.
That's a norm. I mean, you know, it was interesting because I wanted to say, first of all, at least you were able to buy those things at Costco.
Yeah.
Which many of these families that we're talking about, of course, would not have that discount because you have to pay $50 to $100 a year, of course, to belong to be a member.
Right. I am fortunate and I'm blessed.
Right.
And if I, you know, if I didn't get them there, if I would have ran out of time, I'd have gone someplace else where I paid more because I can't.
Well, and I'll tell you this. It's funny. You said you would have gone somewhere else. Well, many of these parents and many of these mothers are going to the neighborhood grocery store or whatever it
right.
happens to be within walking distance, typically, someplace in their neighborhood or community, to buy these necessities. And, of course, we know that they're much higher priced and, of course, a lot more difficult. And you know, you talked earlier about, or the senator from the 24th, that the maximum that they're able to have an income for a family of three, a single mom with two kids, is $292 a month.
I can't imagine.
I can't imagine it. I can't. You know, we talk about $292 a month, and I think the average grocery monthly grocery bill of a family is like over $550 a month.
Well, just think about it, Senator. You raised your twins. Right. I raised three kids. When
it's
they
an
were little,
extraordinary expense.
Yes.
Which brings me to another thing, too. So when we talk about this work requirement, when I was pregnant with my twins, the last 2 months, because it was such a high-risk pregnancy, I was on strict bed rest. So I clearly would not have been able to seek normal forms of employment as people are expected. I mean, really, it would have proposed very much a very difficult problem for me in that I don't mind working, never had for years, have worked 7 days a week. But I will tell you, within those 2 months or 2.5 months, I was on strict bed rest, was not able to work. I certainly would not have been able to seek employment. You know, what do we do in situations such as that? You know,
I know there are
some exemptions. But those exemptions are based really upon the sensitivity or the judgment of probably whoever the caseworker is that would have to decide.
It could well be.
Right. And so it does present a very difficult situation for some folks. And, you know, I agree with the governor's veto letter in that we are penalizing kids for the mistakes and at times irresponsibility of their parents, which makes this a whole lot more difficult to stomach. I mean, it's one thing if you want to take away the benefits of the parent that's not seeking work. It's an entirely other thing to take away the additional assistance for the kids who, through no fault of their own, find themselves without. Now, keep in mind, these kids already live without. So what is without minus without? You know, she talked about, the senator from the 24th talked about the family where the kid, you know, was tired when he had gone to school because it was his night to sleep on the floor. That's not anything highly unusual. I'm not at all surprised to hear that. You know, I mean, that happens every day in some of our poorest neighborhood and poorest communities. And you know...
Well, Senator, I know for a fact it happens in my district, and I'm sure it happens in
yours. Oh, absolutely. It happens every day. It happens every day. So, you know, we talk about the benefits, and what about parents? You know, I talked about the last 2 months of my pregnancy when I was having my kids, but what about these parents that have very small babies? You know, 27% of these families have babies that are 0 to 1 year old.
Yeah.
And another 34% have preschool age kids 2 to 5. You know, it's one thing that you're able to drop the kids off at daycare while you're seeking work. It's an entirely other thing if you happen to have a child that may be ill for a while, maybe the mom's ill for a while, for several weeks or a couple months. You know, you think about, you know, I just think there's a whole array of issues for which this would provide, you know, difficulty. And, you know, we talk about TANF recipients and they're engaging in work activities. And I think the federal government requires 50% of those families at least, you know, have to be seeking work or we would be penalized. You know, they would, of course, come after some of our benefits we receive. But, you know, the interesting thing here is in Missouri, for those who want to, they have done a great job at getting folks off the system. And I will tell you that the federal government gives us credit for that 50%, the more we're able to transition people off of benefits. Now, it's extremely difficult already to qualify for benefits here in Missouri. We are the lowest in the country at $292 a month for a maximum for a family of three. So, you know, we grow through this year after year. And, of course, the senator from Barrie has indicated he has worked on this since he was in the House. I'm sure you remember similar legislation, of course, when we served in the House. And so we've been going through this motion for years, for several years. And it is disheartening because it does hurt those folks that need our help the most. It does. And it doesn't just hurt folks in urban areas. It hurts the folks in rural areas as well. You know, I looked up a couple weeks ago, well, several weeks ago, I think the top 10 poorest counties in Missouri. And five of those counties happen to be in one Senate district. I think the three fall into another. And I think the five, where are my notes? I had old notes. Five of the poorest counties in Missouri are in the 25th. Three of the top 10, of course, happen to be in the 33rd. But, you know, when we look at those areas of the state, not just urban areas, but also rural areas that really, really have folks in those areas that are suffering, that really need our help the most, you know, it's just consideration, of course, that we should give. And I agree with the governor's veto letter in that it's one thing that you penalize the parents. It is another thing to then penalize those children who, through no fault of their own, find themselves, you know, more so without potentially diapers or shoes for school or school clothes or all of those things, really, that we don't think about every day because we live a completely different life. I mean, you know, we talked about the first...
It is a different life. You know what those things mean to us? It's time. It's like, oh, do I have the time to run out and do this?
Right.
You know, that's our biggest problem.
Right.
Aren't we lucky?
The senator from the 24th talked about the first day of school. And I will tell you that growing up, the first day of school was like a big deal.
Right.
You know, because we always had new shoes. We had new clothes. We had new underwear, which my great-grandmother would buy every single year. And every year, those would be the things, of course, my sister and I would want to throw to the side, underwear and T-shirts and socks. You know, boring for a small kid, okay? But... you know, it was tradition, too, that we got our hair done before the first day of school. And you know, you really felt new and refreshed on the first day.
Sure.
And, you know, I will tell you that a lot of those things, you know, we take for granted for those other folks that are not able to do those same things for the kids. You know, for kids that may go to school that morning, have not had breakfast, you know, are certainly impacted by whatever else may have happened in their household the night before. And you know, I just think that in this building, and I go back to this, as we look around this building and even this chamber, with all this marble and all this gold leaf and the beauty of all the paintings and all the history that it serves here, it really is important that we don't forget those folks that happen not to be in this building. And it's very, very easy sometimes for us to do as we continue on with our lives. And, you know, it is a very serious issue. And it is a very serious issue from those folks who, you know, she asked earlier, you know, how many folks from your district have come up to visit you? And she said earlier, well, they don't have the time to do this. Well, you know what? They really, it's one thing that they don't have time, but they don't have the money or the resources to be able to come here either. They don't.
That's exactly right. My school groups, I don't have any public school students that come here hardly at all because they can't afford it.
They can't afford it. Very few schools from my district actually come to the Capitol anymore because many of them do not have the resources or the busing to be able to come. I mean, that's just the reality of where things have gone the past several years. And So it is a difficult issue, and it's one that I hope that that many of us think about, in that many of us in this chamber, especially as you look around the room, live a very blessed lifestyle, and many of these things are not, because it's not our social reality, we are less impacted by what specifically many of these things mean when it says you cannot make any more than $292 a month.
You know, I don't, so...
Because that means something.
That $292, whatever the income limit is?
Well, that's a family of three, and that's
right.
What
well,
I...
What is the earned wages? Is that earned wages? Your earned wages can only be so much to qualify for the benefits? You can't make over a certain amount of money?
Right.
Okay.
You know, I'm not... Certain. Here's the thing. I think once that they are able to make certain wages and limits, of course, they would come off the program, which is what this is designed to do. Now, I don't think anybody in this room has a problem with self-sufficiency. We don't. But many times when you have folks that are struggling the most and the poorest of the poor, many times if they have even one setback, they're back on the system. You know, when you're in a position where you have then been able to come off of TANF, and then able to continue to work in a job where you're making probably a little more than you would have been able to qualify. All it takes is one day somebody stealing a wallet or losing a wallet or a car breaking down or your phone being disconnected where you can't call your ride, anything for you to be able to get to work. One huge setback really puts you back on the system. So these are still the poorest of, these are still the poorest of the poor that we're talking about. So, you know, I think we can go on about this all day long. I think, but it really is a very serious issue as we talk about continually making changes to a program. And as I said, none of us in this room have a problem with being taught or teaching others self-sufficiency. But in teaching others self-sufficiency, we really need to make sure that some of those other folks, like their kids, are not
protected.
Impacted,
yeah.
Really, by the... You know, by the decisions of their parents. And if you have one that's a parent that's very irresponsible or maybe has slight mental illness but hasn't been diagnosed and maybe they haven't been looking or maybe they've forgotten or maybe there's issues, you know, with addiction coupled with mental illness or some of those other things, then those kids really are the ones who suffer. And I think any of us in here understand, may not agree with, but at least understand the principle of taking benefits away from the parent. But when you also take it away from the children who certainly do not understand, certainly cannot then, many times are even mature enough to encourage their parents either to look or to recognize what it means to even be impacted by the cut, that I think it presents an even greater problem. So I did want to share some of those thoughts. You know, I think, you know, sometimes we forget. And, you know, it was interesting because the senator from the 5th, said, you know, for the show me state, that show me state isn't showing her anything. I'm like, well, no, it's actually showing me a whole lot.
Yeah.
It is showing us that this is the hardest, really, for families who are in need of help, in need of assistance, to be able to get the assistance that they need to help take care of their kids. And I agree with the senator from the 5th earlier that, you know, most of these folks in this program, they don't want to be on TANF.
No.
These are not folks that wake up every day and decide that they want to be on welfare every day. That's not what's happening here. But for whatever reason, whether it happens to be lack of education or lack of employment or lack of opportunity, a lot of these families are in despair. They really, really are. I don't think anybody wants to think that they would make less than $300 a month and be able to qualify. I don't think anyone's goal when they wake up in the morning is say, let me figure out how I can go get on TANF.
Yeah.
No, it isn't. So, you know, with that, and you know, we haven't even talked about, when we talk about the unemployed childless adults, I guess we just kind of let them starve, I guess, maybe. I mean, we know that there are lack of jobs out there. We know the jobs are difficult to find. And for those folks that are adequately really seeking employment but not finding it, well, I mean, what do we do? You know, so, in as much as I said we're within these four walls, it is very easy for many of us to go on our day-to-day duties and our day-to-day lives and be caught up in the rat race of whatever it is that we do, which is a lot. But I think many times we forget what that means to that person who happens to be. I think we hear $292 a month and we don't think about what essentially that means. We hear $292 a month, but we really don't think about what that means or the lack,
right,
really, that it means and what people are already living without. And, you know,
well, when
it happens
I heard that today, it put things in perspective for me for what I did this weekend.
Right.
I'm like, I can't imagine.
Right. So I just, I mean, in some ways there's no sense in sometimes beating a dead horse, but certainly, you know, when we talk about those areas that need assistance or need our help or the areas, you know, of the state that happens to be the poorest, and sometimes folks tend to think it's an urban problem, but it's really not more of an urban problem. It really is a rural and an urban problem as well.
And, it's a statewide problem.
It is. It is. It is. So thank you for the inquiry. I'm excited about your granddaughter, of course, arriving. I know you're quite happy and quite excited, and so I look forward to seeing them again.
Wednesday morning, you'll get to meet her.
That's awesome. All righty. Thank you for the inquiry.
Thank you, Senator.
Further discussion. Senator from the First, for what purpose do you rise?
To inquire the Senator from Barry.
Senator from Barry, do you yield?
Yes, I do.
He does. Proceed.
Good afternoon, Senator. How are
Good
you?
Afternoon.
So I wanted to ask a little bit about the fiscal note on this, and bearing in mind, I know that I think we would have had this scored when the conference committee report came through previously in the same manner as we have it scored now. But can you explain to me how it is the estimated net effect on general revenue is likely to be negative? I mean, it seems to me by shortening benefits, we would be limiting outlays. I recognize that there are some implementation costs with what we're doing, but it is not immediately obvious to me why this would cost us money. Could you explain that to me?
Could you ask that question? I didn't quite follow you.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I'm looking at the fiscal note on the conference committee substitute, LR number 0498-15, and it estimates that the net effect on general revenue would be negative. It claims $401,088 in FY16, less than $48,000 for FY17, less than $47,000 for FY18. So could you just explain to me why this costs us money, supposedly, and why, I mean, it would seem to me that after year one, it would seem to me that we're on a glide path downward in terms of the cost expense, but I would think, and maybe it's that the TANF funds aren't general revenue funds, and that's the deal, I'm missing that piece of it. Is there a separate section of the fiscal note that talks about where we save a bunch of money by cutting people off benefits?
No, I don't think so. But the federal dollars are about 2-to-1 of the general revenue dollars. But it's estimated that the total savings for the program will be around $21 million.
Where do you see that?
More. That was just an estimate that...
Is that not in the fiscal note?
No.
And I'm not disagreeing with that assessment.
Yeah.
I mean, it would seem to me that there is a group of people that the difference between 45 months and 60 months is real money, both to them and to the state. I remember the very beginning of the discussion of this issue that we were talking about, you know, a substantial eight-figure sum of money that was at issue here, but I'm sort of stumped as to why we don't see that in the fiscal note. A question I might have asked when the conference committee report was before the body, but it's never too late until we take our next vote, so I'm asking now.
Yeah. Well, we would use those savings, you know, for other programs that have benefits, such as child care, education, transportation assistance, job training. I think those are all positive things.
But I look at the fiscal note and I don't see where we save that money. I mean, I see.
It's really where the program itself is saving the money. The same amount of money is in the pool, so it's not like we're returning it back to general revenue.
Explain that to me. I'm sorry, I missed what you just said.
It's a block. This is a block grant, of course, from the federal government.
Got it.
And
okay.
Then the state.
They're not GR dollars.
Right. But the state does put in some GR dollars.
Okay.
You know, but that stays in the program itself.
Right.
And so, if there's any savings in the program itself, those dollars stay in the program and are used for other functions, such as education, job training, child care, things like that.
Got it. So it just would seem to me that the fiscal note would reflect that fact. It just seems odd to me that I don't see that reflected. Maybe it is, and I'm not recognizing it. I mean, I see a $22 million line item on page 4 that talks about MWA contracts per fiscal year,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know that that's what you're talking about. I mean, maybe it is, but, you know, it indicates, starting at the bottom of page 3 here, in October of 14, there were about 3,300 temporary assistance applications received, a little less than 21,000 participants subject to work requirements, with 4,500 or a little less being exempted. So I think that all that paragraph is saying is that based on those totals, we assume about a fifth of applicants would be exempt from work activity requirements. And I think the estimate is that about 2,600 per month would be subject to work activities. Then it goes on to say that MWA contracts total $22 million and change per year. It says it on page 4.
Mm-hmm.
MWA is Missouri Work Assistance. But I don't think that there we're talking about realizing savings from eliminating benefits for people. So can you explain to me how it is this either saves us money, as you assert, or costs us money, as the fiscal note appears to suggest? I'm not certain at this point that it's clear to me.
No, I cannot explain that.
I understand. Well, now, I say that, you know, the note, I'm sorry, I really am trying to figure this out. Continue on to page 5, it does say there'd be savings from a 10-week sanction period. Total annual savings would be $16 million.
Yes. Yeah, total savings would be $16,285,000.
And I get that, but what I just don't understand is why that doesn't pop up in the bottom line.
I guess I would just have to refer that to
our friends in fiscal oversight.
Yes, our friends in fiscal oversight.
Sure.
Because I don't always agree with the fiscal oversight.
No, I certainly don't either.
And I don't think any of us do completely.
Sure.
And, you know, they're having to make assumptions of the consequences of the program. And that's difficult to get some really hard data.
Sure. Well, I'm just going through, you know, the fiscal note delineates the fact that the TANF block grant is $217 million and change. Now, it says here that DSS would be required to set aside $4.3 million for alternative to abortion services and awareness programs. And I'm on page 11 of the fiscal note here. It says DSS is required to utilize TANF funding in a manner that meets one of the four purposes of TANF: temporary assistance for needy families, ending the dependence of needy parents on government benefits by promoting job preparation, preventing and reducing the incidence of out-of-wedlock pregnancies, and establish annual numerical goals for preventing and reducing the incidence of those pregnancies, and then encouraging the formation and maintenance of two-parent families. says in order to receive TANF funding, contractors would be required to provide services that meet one of the four purposes described above and meet TANF block requirements. Your bill, Senate Bill 24, does that, correct? That's where that requirement is found?
Mm-hmm, yes.
All right, so at 217, it says DSS would be required to set aside $4.3 million for alternatives to abortion services and awareness programs, $4.3 million for activities promoting healthy marriage and responsible fatherhood.
Yeah, that's 2%, I believe.
Right, and that set aside is established in the bill?
Right.
That is not in current law?
No.
Okay, so among the other things that this bill is doing is it is channeling 2%, a little bit more than $4.3 million, for activities promoting healthy marriage and responsible fatherhood on one hand, as well as an additional 2% or $4.3 million+ in alternatives to abortion services and awareness programs. So we're doing that in this bill too, correct?
Yeah, that was amendments placed in the House.
Got it. The House's idea.
That was the House's idea.
Yeah. And again, obviously the bill changed quite a bit when I got over to the House. I think that's part of the reason you've got some of the degree of consternation at the moment that you've seen. Not that there was, you know, great delight on the part of, I think, many senators in the minority with this bill when it left the Senate, but I think the impression that I get from the proceedings today is that most of us vastly prefer our chamber's work to either the House's work or the conference committee report. So could you just tell me a little bit more about the House alternatives to abortion language?
That was suggested by some religious institutions, it would dedicate funding for education, sexually transmitted diseases,
sure,
things like that, through Department of Social Services.
Well, and look,
and I think, you know, it just gives the options for planning your health as a woman.
Sure.
And I think that's a benefit.
Are these, so this alternative to abortion services and awareness programs, that is to be DSS funded? That is a public operation as opposed to being executed,
yes,
or performed by
the public? Yeah, we fund that in the budget right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So
I can't tell you exactly how much we fund it by, but
sure, and that's fine. I wouldn't expect that you could. I'd be impressed if you did, but I understand.
I want to say a few $100,000.
Sure. Well, and I'll say I think that I take no exception to promoting, preferably through the nonprofit sector, alternatives.
Yeah.
When you get public dollars involved, I get a little less comfortable, but at the same time, I think that alternatives to abortion are important, and prevention is important.
Yes,
and while
is.
You and I might not agree with everything that every dollar in that $4.3 million is going to get spent on, I got to tell you, I probably agree with most of it. I do think that's important.
I would think that we could probably overall say, hey, this is a good idea.
Yeah. I just wish we could get there without doing it at the expense of...
And that was something that just, you know, it came from the House. That,
sure.
I think the fatherhood program is very good also.
I do too.
You know, and I agree with that.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then we've got some dedicated funding for that too.
Right.
And it's not subject to appropriations anymore.
No, and I get that. I really do. I just wish that, you know, those two line items, in essence, were not consuming 40% of the savings that we're realizing from this bill. Not that it's necessarily bad policy. It's just it's a resource allocation issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's a resource allocation issue. So there's another chapter in this fiscal note. I think it starts at page 13. Savings due to modifications to the SNAP or temporary assistance benefits. It's talking about 208.244.2, which I assume is a new or modified section in the bill. I'm trying to turn to it here. Oh, yeah, there it is. It's actually the very last, the next to last provision in the bill, page 9 of the bill, line 6, or the second line 6, under 208.244.2. where we say that any ongoing savings resulting from a reduction in expenditures due to modification of SNAP or temporary assistance shall be used to provide child care assistance for single-parent households, which is laudable, it just comes at a price, education assistance, transportation assistance, and job training for individuals receiving benefits under such programs is allowable under applicable state or federal law. And again, all great things, but with the trade-off, largely fueled by the fact that benefits would be shortened.
And I really like the child care part. You know, we have a lot of single mothers that are limited as how much money they can make, or else they're going to lose their child care. And it's kind of a cliff effect, which I've never agreed with.
Sure. But, Senator, this is an important point in this discussion. We're experiencing revenue growth this year, and in fact, more robust revenue growth than we have at any time in the last several years, almost the entire time that I've been in this building. We had another decent year somewhere along the line, but revenue is growing. And so without raising taxes or cutting anything else, there is new money. And I recognize the Appropriations Committee went through the process, and the House and Senate, and we as a body went through the process of, in essence, dividing up that pie. But it just seemed to me that, you know, if these fatherhood programs and these alternative to abortion programs and these other assistance programs were so important, and I agree that they're important to do, I just don't understand why it is that we elect to fund them out of benefits that are currently available under law, as opposed to through revenue growth. We have revenue growth. I mean, $4.3 million for two different line items. You know, we have that. We have that just for sitting still. You don't have to limit people's benefits to come up with the money. We have revenue growth to support it, and admittedly, there's a trade-off, right? I mean, if you take $8.6 million out of revenue growth, and whether it's GR or another source, and put it to these programs, obviously that trades off with other priorities as well. I'm just saying that in this environment, you know, we don't have to be... You can gain support for these programs without time-limiting people who aren't in a very good position, would not choose to be in that position. They find themselves in that position, maybe as a product of choices they had made, but nobody walks out the door and strives to be on TANF for 46 to 60 months as opposed to 45 months or less.
You know, I would love to see this program not even exist.
So would I. I really would. Mm-hmm. Not because I don't think it should be available for those who need it. I would just love to live in a world where nobody needs it, and I think you would too.
Yeah. And, you know, and I would like to see, my objective here is to have fewer people on this program because they would be working, and then you would have savings because the money stays in the program, and you can use those savings because more people are working to help with child care and education and job training.
And I really do understand what you're trying to do in that regard. I am not taking exception to that notion. I just wish we could do it. In an environment where revenue is growing, I wish we could do it without it coming at the expense of some of our very poorest citizens. Because let's face it, there are many people who become TANF recipients who are TANF recipients for considerably less than 45 months.
Yes.
A lot of people.
The average is like 22.
Right, yeah. Which is great. Mm-hmm. Which is great. We want that average to be as low as it possibly can be. Because that's a sign that people are able, that it is truly temporary, that people are able to get to an earning position that allows them to be off of government assistance, which is, again, is what we want. It is our objective. The problem is, even though the average is 22 months, as you suggest, the reality is there are people who are out there for more than double that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Not nearly as many, but not none, far from none. And those are the folks who in my view, have some of the greatest challenges. I think if they could put themselves in a position of being able to command a higher income, I think most of them would. The reality is, they're as much as ours is a land of opportunity. Unfortunately, it is not always in a land of opportunity for all. I mean, we talk about concepts like full employment. At 5 to 6%, we say we are fully employed when 1 in 20 workers is out of work, or 3 in 50. And the reality is that because of the cyclical nature of the economy, at any one point in time,
that goes up and down.
That's right. Well, and people come in and out of unemployment. Some very quickly, others not so much, and again, that depends on the broader economic backdrop. You know, but if we think back 80 years, the mid-1930s, and even before that, starting in late 1929 and going until World War II, really, we went through a much longer than 45 or even 60-month period where things were very bleak for a great many people in this country, notwithstanding large-scale and unprecedented federal intervention in an effort to remediate that. And, I mean, in some ways, what happened in that depression has been defining for our society ever since. Much of the change in Commerce Clause interpretation, much of the basis upon which modern federal regulation in many forms is predicated, much of our fiscal policy can be traced directly back to policy decisions we made in the wake of that depression. I would hope that nobody that is alive today will ever live to see anything like that again.
And that was a worldwide depression also.
That's right.
It wasn't just the United States.
But the point is today, 80-some years later, we are not more independent as a global economy. We are far more interdependent. And, you know, if anything, I mean, and some would attribute Holly Smoot to the tariff changes to would point to the tariff policy, the protectionism that was adopted as a reason the depression happened. I think there were multiple reasons. That was certainly a contributing and or aggravating factor. But the point is, we are not going back to the world of pre-1929 in many ways, although I think some would have us do so. But in terms of our global economy, you know, we are chained together globally in ways today that we never have been before. I mean, to the point that when a nation like Greece, which is, you know, essentially socialistic, it's very much state-centered. When a nation like Greece threatens to take down Europe, threatens to take down the world, I mean, it only takes so much. It only takes so much. And I just worry that time will come when we're not experiencing revenue growth, when the unemployment rate is not half of what it was 5 years ago. I fear a day when it is double what it was 5 years ago. And in that broader context, I really worry that there could be an even greater human cost to the policy change we're contemplating today than we realize. I mean, it's very easy to look at limiting benefits in a time of relatively great employment where the Dow is triple what it was 6 years ago when things seem to be on the upswing. I just worry that we are making policy decisions in the upswing not anticipating cyclical nature of things and the possibility of a future downswing. And, you know, the day may come where the difference, some would say the day is already here, where the difference between 45 and 60 months is a really big deal, puts people in really dire straits. And I'm afraid that one day we could be confronted with conditions where it's multiples of...
Well, the 60-month was not where the federal government wanted us to be. It was just the maximum allowable that a person could be on it.
Right. No, I understand that.
Okay. I mean, I want to make sure.
It's a decision that was made in the mid-90s.
Yes.
And I have to say, another speaker previously suggested that was done under a Republican administration. Quite frankly, that was done under a Democratic administration.
It was done under Bill Clinton. But
that's right.
I believe the Republicans had control of both houses at that time. I believe.
They did, but yes. I think it's fair to say, going back to the government shutdown and a lot of other things that happened in that time period, I think it's fair to say we had divided government. Nobody was in a position of unilateralism, which, you know, I think Jefferson and Madison would probably say on most days is not a bad thing. But certainly, I'll say this, had that bill in 1996 been vetoed by President Clinton, I sincerely doubt that there would have been the votes to override. I doubt. Maybe in either chamber.
I doubt.
So, I mean, it was a compromise, and that is what I think the founders want us doing to the greatest extent possible. or wanted us doing. But it was the 60-month limit was done under a Democratic administration. So the House added in this alternatives to abortion and this fatherhood's funding. I know the House shortened us, the conference report shortens us from the 48 months that left this chamber to the 45 months before us now. Could you please just tell me what else is different from what we were talking about back in February in this room?
It's mainly the lifetime benefits. Of course, you mentioned about the alternatives to abortion and the fatherhood. Those were things added on in the House. But it was the lifetime benefits. The House had cut it back to, I believe, 24 months. Yes, 24 months.
Right.
And that was a little severe. And so through negotiations, we did get it back up quite a bit to the 45 months. So those are really the only three things that are different.
And let me say this.
Because we wanted to keep in the face-to-face contacts, you know, with the recipient, which we did.
And I think that's important, and I appreciate that. And let me say this about your efforts. I know that you were involved in extensive discussions when we were perfecting this bill at the start of session. And I know that yourself, the senator from the 24th, and some other members of the body had a lot of discussions around that time, and we struck a deal on perfection. And look, all of us did that with eyes wide open, that we are, after all, in a bicameral legislature, knowing that the folks on the other side of the building were going to have something to say about that. And respectfully, and the senator from the 24th has pledged not to talk all day and all night about this, and
we did have a spousal asset disregard that was put on by the House also. It disregards a new spouse's income and assets for 6 consecutive months once in a lifetime.
Is that in the conference report?
Yes.
Forgive me, do you happen to have that provision handy? Could you just point me to it?
It's section, I don't have the bill with me, but it's section 208.026.
That's helpful.
0.7.
208.026. Very good. Thank you. What I was about to say is, look, we all knew that when this left the Senate, that the House was going to have input on it. And while, admittedly, we were not able to hold the line on the Senate position, for the most part, that's not how most conference committees go. And we could have taken up the House's version and simply passed that.
Mm-hmm.
We did.
We could have. Yeah.
We sent it to conference, and while there are some provisions in this bill that are here because of the House that I'm really not crazy about, I mean, enough in the case of the senator from the 7th to get him from being a yes on the overall package to being a no on the overall package.
And I understood that. I understood that.
What I would say is that in conference, we didn't hold everything to the Senate position. But on some things, including the lifetime limit, we came a lot closer to the Senate position to the House position.
And yes, that we did.
That is not lost on some of us.
Yes, and that took some doing.
Yeah, no, and I understand that.
To get leadership in the House to be in favor of that.
Yeah.
Or at least to stand down on it. Yeah. I wouldn't say they're in favor, but they stood down.
And in that regard, I will say I know that in that process, you went to bat for the Senate position, and I respect that, I appreciate that, I value that, I think it speaks well of the Senate conferees. There are a lot of us who would just assume not pass a bill, or let's talk about work requirements without reducing lifetime, without departing from the federal standard. But we are where we are. Collectively, we've done the best we can, and all I will say is, though I object to particularly the change from 60 to 45 in this bill, I do stand here recognizing this bill could look a whole lot worse than it does. and that, at least from my point of view.
And I always listen to all sides, because I don't have the answers for everything.
Sure. You mentioned that there was another provision, 208.026, but I lost the reference after the 026.
Sure. It's 208.026.
Point seven. Okay. And that language says, in order to encourage the formation and maintenance of two-parent families, something we all support, when a temporary assistance for needy families benefits recipients marries, the new spouse's income and assets shall be disregarded for 6 consecutive months. The disregard shall be a once-in-a-lifetime benefit for the recipient, which is to say, we don't want to penalize people for marriage.
That's right. And they will have an extra 6 months. You know, if they marry, their spouse is making $30,000 or $40,000 a year, say, you know, they're going to keep, you know, their benefits for 6 more months.
If they so choose. Now, they would also have the option of saying,
yes,
I've just married somebody, and as a result,
uh-huh,
our married income takes us out of TANF eligibility. Just on the off chance that I find myself in that position at some time later in time,
mm-hmm,
I'm going to go ahead and forego the 6-month grace period. And that way, if they so choose to pursue that route and yet find themselves on TANF at some time in the future, you know, they would still have preserved whatever of their 45 months is left.
And, you know, we do have language in this bill, and I can't tell you where it is because I don't
have
the bill with me. But that would, if in extenuating circumstances, you know, say a person has expired their lifetime benefits, but maybe there was some abuse, you know, from their spouse or whatever, and they lost their job because of it. So there are some extenuating circumstances that the person can be put back on the program again.
Yeah. No, I understand that, and I will say I suspect that we'll be getting this to an override vote at some point this evening. And I do think that while we were not able to hold the Senate provision on everything, there is language in here that the House has added that, such as the provision we were just talking about, that makes it a better bill.
Mm-hmm.
I do acknowledge that we came a lot closer to holding the Senate position on many aspects of this bill than we might have, and I do recognize both that fact and your role in making that happen.
Thank you.
For that, I do appreciate your efforts on behalf of the Senate. Thank you for the inquiry, Senator. Mr. President?
Senator from the first.
May I inquire the Senator from the fourth?
Senator from the fourth, do you yield?
I do.
He does proceed.
Senator, how are you this evening?
You know, I'm good. There's a lot of things going on this evening.
There are. You know, I know the Senator from the 14th is under the weather, but I think apart from her and until just now you, I think we have heard from most members of the minority caucus on this issue, but I wanted to be sure that we had the chance to hear your thoughts on the motion now before the body to override the governor's veto.
Well, you know, I've got a couple of thoughts. Number one, I agree with you and your analysis of the Senator from Barry's efforts. I think the Senator from Barry, number one, even during the negotiations, was extremely accommodating, at least to the minority caucus. And I think he did a very outstanding job in the conference committee with the Senate position. Now, that being said, I never did like the bill.
Right.
I never voted for it.
Yeah, I think you were a no from the beginning.
I was a no from the beginning. But, you know, that's why he's in one party, I guess, and I'm in a different one. You know, it's, I think you read the governor's veto memo here, and it does some pretty atrocious things here. And I know I've said it on the floor before, and I'm sure I'll say it again before my tenure here is up, but, you know, $5 isn't a lot of money unless you don't have it.
Right.
Some of these people, $228 or $292 a month, that could keep them sustained. It could keep them, you know, it does make their life. So it's very important for them. It's very hard. I understand the politics of welfare reform.
You know, I have to tell you, I'm not sure that I do, to tell you the truth. I mean, I get that work participation requirements make sense. I get that there are some other good provisions in this that I was just going through with the senator from Barrie. But I'm not sure I do understand the politics of why we have to do some of these things and make certain positive steps on this policy front in the same stroke as terminating 3,155 families on January 1, 2016, including approximately 6,465 children. I'm not sure why we have to do that in order to do all these other things. It seems to me that we've imposed a trade-off on ourselves that we need not make.
I agree. I agree with that assessment. And just so you and I are clear, I understand the politics of doing it. I'm not sure I care much for the procedures that we're utilizing. You know, it's. I mean, you touched on it a little bit. Bill Clinton, you know, that was the largest welfare reform package I think ever, and he put a lot of people back to work, and he negotiated that. What was that, 92, 94?
No, it was 96.
96.
I mean, it was sort of coming ever since. I mean, the handwriting was on the wall. You had a change in the majority in both houses of Congress in 1994 in those elections, which were either dreadful or spectacular, depending on your point of view. But in 1994, for the first time in almost a half century, I think since under Eisenhower, both chambers of Congress flipped to Republican control.
Right.
And as a result, there was always going to be some kind of change. I mean, at the time, it was AFDC, Aid to Families with Dependent Children.
Right.
Dependent Children. It's Monday. Aid to Families with Dependent Children. You know, there was always going to be a welfare reform bill as a result of that. And I was talking with Senator from the 7th. It was around this time of year in 1996, plus or minus a month, that the bill finally was signed by President Clinton. But it is my understanding, and I could stand corrected on this, that that was when we went from calling it AFDC to calling it TANF.
I think that's accurate. I really do. And that's typically what happens when you make major changes. You rebrand it, which is what we did.
Right.
And, you know, like so many other issues, we... keep trying. I thought back in 1996, I thought once that was done, we were done. You know, we've done everything that everybody wants to do. You can't convince me that this is $292 for a family of three is runaway government spending. You can't convince me that people are living the life of luxury on $292 a month.
No.
We've got it pretty well reined in. And like so many other programs, we keep building on. I mean, we do it with the tax cuts. 1986, Ronald Reagan cut the marginal income tax rate from 91% down to 59%. Sure, it was to stimulate the economy. Now, because he did that and because it worked, in Missouri, we cut it from 5 to 5.5 when we expect the same kind of results? I don't think so. Buy into that kind of attitude or that kind of philosophy, and they keep trying to recycle the same old successful programs.
Well, we'll see what happens in Missouri. I mean, we had a major policy change last year, and we're probably going to wind up implementing sort of phase one of a five-tier phase-in after this fiscal year. We'll see. I mean, if we keep getting growth, with any luck, we will be living in the environment of being able to enjoy increased revenue while cutting taxes, and that's a great place to be if you can be there. The challenge is sustaining it, and, oh, by the way, what happens when the economy turns south on you?
Right.
And is it going to be that much worse because you're going to have eroded your tax base somewhat just by virtue of the change to the rate structure? It's great. Look, if you're going to have years of perpetual growth, no problem. but that's the trick.
Right.
And we've had We've had two significant downturns in the last 15 years that have created somewhat unprecedented budget circumstances in our state. And while finally revenue is growing again, you know, if that, I think the experience of the last 15 years has taught us that we would be fools to assume that that will always be the case.
Right, right. And, you know, we're going to get into this chicken versus the egg argument. You know, do we get increased revenue growth because of the tax cuts, or did the revenue grow despite the tax cuts? I gave a little message here. Hold on 1 second, Senator.
Yeah, no, I understand. Well, we shall see. Hopefully, our state's economy will continue to demonstrate robust growth for an indefinite number of years into the future, and the tax policy change we made last year will more than pay for itself, and that'll be fantastic. I just worry about what happens when the music stops.
Well, and that's what we don't want to do, is put ourselves in a position where we're in dire straits without a safety net. And that's what I think, that's one of the areas that I'm most concerned with.
Well, I share your concern, Senator, and I don't want to keep you too long, but to this point in the proceedings, among the healthy members of our caucus, I think you were the only one remaining who we hadn't heard from on this, so I wanted to get to you before we got too far down the road here.
Well, I was waiting my time. I was waiting my turn. But we have a very engaged caucus, and this is an issue that's very important to them.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I appreciate that. Senator, thank you for the inquiry. Mr. President, may I inquire of the senator from the 11th?
Senator from the 11th, do you yield?
For?
And the inquiry from the senator from the 1st.
Oh, yes.
He does. Proceed.
You know, I don't know if you're in here earlier. The senator from Cole was in the chair, and I believe the senator from the 24th and the senator from the 5th were beginning an inquiry, and it was suggested that perhaps I was, you know what, it might have been the senator from Barry and the senator from the 24th were beginning an inquiry, and it was suggested that I was moving between them at about that time. However, the senator from the 24th had not yet yielded, so while the chair seized the opportunity to admonish me regarding the rules, I did not hear the gavel strike, and for that I greatly appreciate it. Now, that said, the senator from Johnson is now in the chair, so I'm going to make good and sure that if nothing else, I'm facing the
desk. I didn't think you were in between now.
Say that again?
Yeah, I didn't think you went between the debate. That was just my opinion.
I appreciate that.
I don't know about the senator from the 24th when you were inquiring the senator of the 7th. That may be a different issue.
You know, all I will say is that I have quite literally been right there before myself.
Right. And we have her trapped right now, so that's something.
That's right. Well, you you know, you made some good points earlier. I was appreciative of your comments regarding the governor's veto message. You know, we're talking about...
Well, you, thank you for that, but really... My point is that the governor made really good points. You know, it was a very succinct, brisk, crisp, to the point. He's not going to support something that hurts kids.
Yeah,
and that's it. And I think a lot of times we look at these things that we think are helping and they're not. And there's been lots of discussion on this floor about. I think the senator from the 9th, the senator from 13th talked about the need that a lot of people have, but the truth of the matter is whether these people are doing their work activity or not, whether they're part of the system and doing their best or not, the kids suffer.
Right.
That's what's wrong with this legislation. I guess, in fairness, you could go after some folks who aren't doing what they need to be doing and receiving our tax money. That makes sense. But these kids, they can't help it if their parent is trying their best or not trying at all. They're still getting hurt. So that's a point I wanted to bring up again, that make sure that we're not really going after the folks. We're hurting some folks who have nothing, they can't do anything about their situation.
Right,
Well, 3,155 families, not 3,154 or 3,156, but 3,155 families will be terminated January 1, 2016, unless their status changes before then.
Right.
If they're able to leave TANF, they certainly will.
Uh-huh.
But if their circumstances don't change, their circumstances will then change. Again, 6,465 children approximately, 40% of them under the age of five, and so let's just do the quick math on that. That's about 1,200, a little bit more than 1,200 children under age five that will see their families lose benefits. And the governor makes the point that there will be tens of thousands like them in the future, unless the fundamentals are radically altered. Just with the throughput of people coming into and exiting TANF and what we know about the likelihood that any person that takes day one of TANF benefits will still be there at 45 months as opposed to 60, it will be tens of thousands of children in the future. I mean, we kind of forget about it. We talk about the policy changes that were made in 1996. That's been 20 years ago at the federal level. That's been almost 20 years ago.
Right.
And just think about it 20 years from now. I mean, this legislation is going to impact thousands of families in 8 months, in 7 months. Think about how many families it's going to impact in perpetuity.
Right.
If it's another 20 years before we see a major policy change.
Right, over the next generation.
Well, that's right. And look, economic history tells us that there are going to be significant downturns along the way. And that's before you factor in just the fundamental change in the nature of our economy and what productivity levels are going to do, what globalization is going to do, what the conversion to a service-based economy is going to continue to do, what's been going on in the manufacturing sector.
You know, you mentioned in your inquiries about how our economy is improving and we're doing better than we did from the downturn before.
For the moment.
And with that said, the gap between the haves and the have-nots keep growing. So even in an economy where we have a record Wall Street numbers and we have record profits of corporations, that doesn't necessarily mean that the poorest of the poor will diminish. They may actually grow, Senator, and more people may need this assistance. Unfortunately, that's the kind of economy that we have. I think that this will be that issue of this gap, this wealth gap, will be the biggest issue that we have in our upcoming presidential race. And I think the people of the country will try to figure out who can deal with that. But I think just because we see us growing doesn't necessarily mean that this assistance is going to be needed for more people. So,
and to your point, yeah, growth benefits different people differently.
Right.
And it benefits different people differently in a way that is different than it did in prior generations.
I guess maybe that's my point. I think it's some of this growth that we've had lately is different. Now we're digging ourselves out of a hole of the collapse we had in 2008 at the end of that year, of the third quarter of that year. But
yeah,
we're moving in the right direction, but these things are still needed, and these kids that we're talking about are real, and there could be a lot of impact for future kids.
Right. Well, and you look at studies demonstrating just the effects of poverty on people, particularly children, what it does physiologically, or at least what it correlates with physiologically. It's a real concern. It's a real concern. And we're talking about, concern isn't a strong enough word, I'm sorry. It's terrible is what it is. Poverty is terrible. Children in poverty is absolutely terrible.
Right.
What it does to them, both in the short term and the long term. And look, they're not the ones who, they find themselves in this position through absolutely no fault of their
That's
own.
Right.
Absolutely no fault
That's
of
right.
their own. And we are making a difficult situation that they already find themselves in worse.
Right, and I think I said this before, I think it was in Quarantine Center from the 5th, in the governor's letter, he talks about the idea of a protective payee to receive and administer children's share. That may have been a solution to make this bill better so it doesn't actually hurt kids that are poor. And if you want to have the argument that these folks need to get up off the couch and start doing some work activity, that's a conversation we could have. But right. These kids have nothing to do with that. Whether it is these folks can't do the work activity because of circumstances or they don't want to, it doesn't make a difference. The same thing goes to the kids. They don't get benefits. They don't get the assistance. And that's what's the real flaw of this bill.
Right. Among others. Well, and as I discussed with the Senator from Barrie, I do think there are some good provisions in this bill. Some things that do improve on how we do things currently.
What do you think is the good provisions of the
bill? Well, you know, look, I think to the extent we have the resources to advocate for responsible fatherhood, I think that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
To the extent there's a provision that the House added that removes what amounts to a marriage penalty for TANF recipients, I think that removes a disincentive for marriage. And again, we want to promote that.
Right.
Or at the very least, we don't want to punish.
Right, and we want to promote that because we want those two adults to help take care of that child.
That's right.
Right?
Possible, yeah. Certainly when you're talking about a situation where one of the parents is impoverished to the point of being a TANF recipient,
mm-hmm.
despite what they do to earn. The average, as the governor points out, the average TANF benefit is $228 a month in Missouri, and to be eligible to receive that amount, a family of three cannot earn more than $292 a month. We've talked about that number, but when you think about it, that's really quite remarkable. And what you're looking to have three human beings live on in a month is, I'm sure there's a way to do it, but and I'm sure there are parts of the world where a lot of people manage to do that all the time, but in this country, that is poverty.
Right.
That is poverty.
Right.
And the people that are impacted the most severely are the children.
Right. Again, because they have no way to get out of it themselves. So that's the purpose of this temporary assistance for needy families. And you got to have a kid with a family. That's the flaw of this. And I think the things that you mentioned were good. I think if we would have not drop down the number of months, that could have been a big key to us not having this conversation and the governor
right.
not vetoing it. I think having that protective payee would have been helpful, and maybe even the grandfathering would have been another assistance so these families don't drop off the cliff. These are things I know could have been worked in, were chosen not to be worked in to this
right.
bill, so now we're here. I guess...
Yeah.
The political reality is that this governor has vetoed quite a number of things and has been overridden quite a bit. So the calculation there is perhaps, well, we'll just override him and get our way. But the problem is that there's 6,400 kids that this affects, and that's why it's important to talk about.
That's right. No, I agree. Well, look, it would seem to me it's the very least that we can do.
Right.
That would be the very least that we can do. Well, Senator, that's all the questions I have for you at this time. I do want to go to the Senator from the 24th for a moment.
Thank you.
Well. Mr. President, to inquire from the Senator of the 24th.
Senator from the 24th, do you yield?
I do. Thank you.
She does. Proceed.
Senator, I note, I think the Senator from the 4th needed to head elsewhere within the building. I think there's something going on the House side that he needed to attend to. I did want to inquire of you during this debate. I've already asked the Senator from Barrie his vantage with respect to sort of what changed between perfection in the Senate and adoption of the conference committee report, but I sort of wanted to get your side of that story as well.
Right. Well, thank you. So, interestingly, one of the things that we originally had agreed to on the Senate side was what the Senator from Barrie refers to as the third meeting, what I refer to as the second meeting. This is the meeting in that 10-week period after 50% of the sanction has been cut from the family because the family wasn't in compliance during a six-week period. And we actually had an oversight on the Senate side that left that next meeting, that face-to-face meeting out, even though we all know the critical importance of that meeting. So it was inadvertently left out when it was drafted, and then, frankly, we had to fight hard, or I feel like I had to fight hard to get that meeting in, because I really believe that people are more likely to succeed if they have an opportunity to review what it is they're supposed to be doing, how what they have to go through to be in compliance, that they know the options, and so that they can hear them, but also if they've run into a problem that may actually be an exemption, that they are clearly talking to the person who's representing, enforcing these TANF rules, that they're talking to that person face-to-face so that we can see if an exemption is the right thing to do for that person on a temporary basis, or perhaps even on a permanent basis, depending upon what that exemption is. So now while that meeting during that 10-week period of time is, it's not required. It is optional. And I think that, again, my sense is that having a face-to-face meeting is valuable to both the TANF recipients and to those who are trying to work with the TANF recipients to provide them with information and access. So we had to fight hard to even get it in as a may, and we did do that. So that's one of the differences from how the bill was going out here. Again, we talked about we had agreed to 48 months here. Eventually, I will tell you, the Speaker of the House came over and met with me and said, you know, we need to find a common ground here, and 45 months sounds like such an unusual number.
Arbitrary.
Right, and the Speaker, you know, the Speaker said, well, you know, we could go with 30 or 36. Some of his members were in support of that. He would be willing to look at 42. You know, I was pushing for the 48 that the Senate had agreed to, and we both eventually settled on that 45, thinking, all right, we're trying to come up with a number that both of us feel like we got something in the negotiation. But again, when you take this back and look at what it does to real families, it's why I'm not able to support the bill. We worked as hard to keep those numbers of months up for those people who are in desperate need for a longer period of time. The other thing that the House did put on was what you had talked about, that I think is a really good provision, that additional 6 months where a spouse's income is disregarded should the recipient want to disregard it. And I think you made a really good point that 6 months is still going to count against your lifetime benefits. So, you know, maybe if you are, as a result of marriage, if you're in good shape and you don't need to take those 6 months then, none of us knows exactly what the future will hold for us, so you may want to hold on to that option. But the other piece that the House put in was that some of these dollars within the TANF block grant could go to support of pregnancy resource centers. And, you know, I frankly, I was disappointed to see that in there. I don't think that actually even falls under the role of TANF.
And if we wanted to support that objective, we certainly have ample alternative means to do so. We don't have to do it here this way.
Right. We do have ample alternative means, and frankly, I'm not sure that at the end of the day, we'll see if the TANF money is even able to be granted for that. So, you know, I don't know that it will be, because it doesn't seem to be in line with what the goals are of a TANF program.
Well, Senator, I know that you have worked incredibly hard on this. I know that... look, I think we're on the same side of this. We're not going to support this override motion. I just appreciate all the work that you have put in on this, and frankly, what the Senator from Barry did in conference to try to hold the Senate position. And I know you had a lot to do with that based on your conversations with the Speaker as well. This is not, I mean, look, I don't support this bill.
Right.
It could be a whole lot worse, and I'm convinced that but for your efforts, it would be a whole lot worse. So, Senator, on behalf of
the constituencies that I represent that may be impacted by this bill. I want to thank you for your efforts on it, and really appreciate your taking the time to yield to my inquiry this evening.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. President.
Further discussion. Seeing none, Senator from Barry, you are recognized. Senator from Cole.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'd like to inquire of the Senator from Barry.
Senator from Barry, do you yield?
Yes, I do.
He does. Proceed.
Senator.
Good evening, Senator. How are you this evening?
I'm fine. Thank you. Had a uneventful drive up here. I saw a fox run right in front of me right before I got to Jenkins.
You're about to get a visit from another fox.
Let's vote.
It's a gray-haired fox. You ever met the gray-haired fox before?
I think I just did.
You sure did. So you had a good drive up here.
Had a good drive up here, and I was somewhat looking forward to it, but in other ways, I was kind of dreading it a little bit because I knew it'd be a long 2 weeks. But I'm
extra. Did you bring extra plenty of extra changes of clothes and everything?
I brought some extra underwear
because our local merchants like getting business.
But you probably, the merchants up here would have appreciated if I wouldn't have brought enough.
That's what I'm getting at. We need to spur the local economy.
Yeah, and you want more revenue, for this is Cole County, right?
This is Cole County.
Okay.
I'm glad you know that the county seat of state government is Cole County. If nothing else, we've determined that tonight.
We have determined that tonight. But, we were talking about I spend a lot of time in the yard. I don't know if you spend any time on the farm this week.
I always do.
But I'm a little
sore. It's a family business.
My wife wanted me to plant some new bushes. And
did that?
With a shovel, and I have to use a bar because I've got so many rocks.
You need an auger.
An auger?
An auger. You know what an auger is?
No.
Oh, man. In pharmacy school, somewhere along the line, they didn't teach you what an auger was?
They didn't teach me what an auger was.
Senator from Webster's over there wondering why we're talking about augers. But he's figured it out. You get an auger, bush planting becomes a lot easier.
Yeah. Well, it's...
I'm glad you were able to do some manual work.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just wanted to thank you for working to... I know there was a lot of compromise. It was worked together originally on this bill in the House. It might not be where everybody needs it, but coming from one of the families who did visit laundromats at 10, 11 o'clock at night with my mother, I understand both sides of the equation. I think this will absolutely help people get a little bit better. So
I hope so. I think so, or else I wouldn't have performed it.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. President.
Further discussion. Seeing none, Senator from Barry, you are recognized to close.
Thank you, Mr. President. I close.
The Senator from Barry closes on the motion. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Brown, Chappelle Nadal, Cunningham, Curls, Dempsey, Dixon, Emery, Hageman, Holzman, Kevney, Kehoe, Kraus, Lavoda, Leibla, Munslinger, Nasheed, Onder, Parson, Pierce, Richard, Riddle, Romine, Sater, Schaff, Schaefer, Schatz, Schmidt, Shoup, Sifton, Sylvie, Wallingford, Walsh, Wasson, Whelan.
Senator from Green, Senator from the 23rd. By your vote of 25-aye, 9-no, the bill having received a two-thirds majority required is declared passed. Senator from Newton.
Mr. President, I would inquire the Secretary if there any conferees be read, and if so, will the Secretary read the message?
There are conferees. Madam Secretary, please read those.
Conference Committee Appointments on House Committee Substitute, Senate Bills number 282 as amended, Senators Parson, Leibla, Whelan, Lavoda, Curls.
Senator Newton.
Well, without objection, the Senate will go to her business of message from the House of Representatives. Ask the Secretary the message.
Madam Secretary, please read the messages from the House.
Mr. President, I am instructed by the House of Representatives to inform the Senate that the House has taken up and passed House Committee Substitute House Bill 180, entitled An Act Relating to Alcohol with an Emergency Clause. Emergency Clause defeated. Also, Mr. President, I am instructed by the House of Representatives to inform the Senate that the House has taken up and passed House Committee Substitute House Bill 1179, entitled An Act Relating to Public Office Vacancies with an Emergency Clause. Emergency Clause defeated. Also, Mr. President, I am instructed by the House of Representatives to inform the Senate that the House has taken up and passed House Bill 1330, entitled An Act Relating to Rental Agreements. Also, Mr. President, I am instructed by the House of Representatives to inform the Senate that the House has taken up and passed Senate Concurrent Resolution 12. Also, Mr. President, I am instructed by the House of Representatives to inform the Senate that the House has taken up and passed Senate Bill 116. Also, Mr. President, I am instructed by the House of Representatives to inform the Senate that the House has taken up and passed House Committee Substitute Senate Bill 156, entitled An Act Relating to Highway Designations, with House Amendment 1, House Amendment 2, House Amendment 4, House Amendment 5. Also, Mr. President, the Speaker of the House has appointed the following committee to act with a like committee from the Senate on House Committee Substitute Senate Bill 282 as amended. Representatives Shull, Gosen, Hill, McNeil, Colonna. Also, Mr. President, I am instructed by the House of Representatives to inform the Senate that the House has taken up and passed House Committee Substitute Senate Bill 13, entitled An Act Relating to Career and Technical Education, with House Amendment 1, House Amendment 2, House Amendment 3, House Amendment 4. Also, Mr. President, I am instructed by the House of Representatives to inform the Senate that the House has taken up and passed House Committee Substitute Senate Bill 164, entitled An Act Relating to Financial Transactions, in which the concurrence of the Senate is respectfully requested. Respectfully submitted, Daniel Adam Crumless, Chief Clerk.
Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. Would you please refer Senate Committee Substitute for House Bill 799, Senate Committee Substitute for House Committee Substitute for House Bills 578, 574, and 584. Senate Committee Substitute for House Bill 100, Senate Committee Substitute for House Bill 529, Senate Committee Substitute for House Bill 1070, Senate Committee Substitute for House Bill for House Committee Substitute for House Bill 796, Senate Committee Substitute for House Committee Substitute for House Bill 976, House Committee Substitute for House Bill 714, House Committee Substitute for House Bill 137, House Bill 279, and Senate Substitute for Senate Bill 540 to the Government Accountability and Fiscal Oversight Committee.
Those bills will be so referred. Senator from Newton.
President, no objections. Senator Gordon, business announcements.
Seeing no objections, announcements. Announcements. Senator from Newton.
Mr. President, no further business come to the body. I move the Senate stand in recess to 8 p.m. this evening.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye. All opposed say no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. We are on recess until 8 p.m. this evening.